Blog Talk Radio.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
has
been
declined. Your unemployment benefits ran out 2 weeks ago.
What do you mean I'm overdrawn?
2 weeks ago.
I still have checks left.
Two weeks ago.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit. Get out of debt and build true financial independence with real estate in 2 hours a week. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She'll show you how, without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagenhall.
Everyone, welcome to 2011. Yay! I'm so excited for this new year. Welcome to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. And for this fabulous New Year's Day 2011, we are broadcasting live from the Log Mahal in Payson, snowy but sunny, Payson, Arizona. And I'm so excited about this new season. Welcome to Season 8. I can't believe we have been broadcasting for so long. Thanks so much for joining us. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome to the broadcast. And we broadcast the Unlock Your Wealth Radio program each and every Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help you manage your finances and attitudes for achieving financial wellness today and financial independence for you and your family for the future. We do this with several different segments and our Keys to Riches Financial Wellness series also. And we have an incredible kickoff show. I'm so excited. Yay. Dean Wagner, star of Downsized, financial coach and personal friend, will be joining us today, as well as Robert Gignac. He will be joining us also. And I am so excited because, well, these are two really awesome authors, and we also are starting our keys over. I'm so excited about that. And our key this week is acceptance and affirmation, and it couldn't be more appropriate than for the first day of the new year to be talking about maybe it's time to make a change in our habits and attitudes towards money and wealth. The new year brings renewed hope and excitement and enthusiasm. As it is starting yet another calendar year, it gives us an opportunity to turn over a new leaf. And for some of us, we've turned over a forest of new leaves, and we still feel like we need to keep turning them over and over again. And they're turned over so many times, they're more than a charred, well-done steak. So how do we get out of that and move forward in a more sensible fashion? Well, our guests are going to help us do that, and then our key in the second hour is also going to help us do that. This whole week, we have been kicking off everything in preparation for today's broadcast for the beginning of Season 8. If you didn't happen to catch Tuesday's Unlock Your Wealth Radio to go, we had our Millionaire Mind focus on creating the new through a mental health millionaire's detox and renewal strategy. And for those of you that joined us, hopefully you took the time to invest and in the process. And hopefully you feel liberated, like you were able to take some weight off of your shoulders, put those bags down you've been carrying, and really focus on making a paradigm shift, not doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result, but doing things differently. Instead of making the same old resolutions that never get resolved. Then on Wednesday's show, which our trivia question comes from Wednesday's show, Wednesday we talked about wrecking the resolutions and creating something way more powerful, affirmations and commitments to our future. We honor our commitments. It's something that's internal. It's built in. When we make a commitment, we honor that. Now, when we use affirmations, and we're going to learn all about that, and that's this week's featured strategy, the affirmation process. When we use affirmations give us the strength and intestinal fortitude we don't currently have to get through things because of childhood dramas, because of conditioning, because of pain and the avoidance of such pain. To help us get the intestinal fortitude or see us through until we have that intestinal fortitude to honor our commitments to ourselves and to others. And we're going to talk about all that this week. Plus, we have incredible Minutes on Your Money articles. I'm so excited. 9 credit card scams you got to watch out for. Also, 9 money goose. That supposedly won't hurt you so much, but I take issue with this article, so we're going to talk about what it really means. I'm going to interpret that for you. I have been seeing a slew of debt settlement commercials and credit counseling commercials and debt settlement commercials guised as credit counseling. What's the difference, and do you know which one, if either, is right for you? Maybe financial coaching is more appropriate. Ways to guard against ID theft. Is your poochie or kitty or fishy bankrupting you? I know, I felt like I had to take a second mortgage out for mine this summer. And how about clean car title but dirty little secret, what you need to know before you make that new car purchase? And 10 useful things you can get for free. We have loads of stuff to get through on today's show, plus your Millionaire Minute and so much more. But first, let's talk about today's trivia question. It is always taken from a previous show broadcast for those of you who are joining us for the first time. So it behooves you, in order to win fabulous prizes valued significantly, to listen regularly. And our trivia question is taken from this week's Midweek Update, which we broadcast every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, where we give you 30 minutes of news, tips, tricks, tools, and information you can use today. And when we wrecked our resolutions, we created another option for ourselves that are much more powerful than New Year's resolutions. I've only ever made one New Year's resolution that stuck, by the way, and that was 15 years ago I made a resolution to not make any more resolutions. And it's worked, but it's the only one. But thank God I got one to work, right? Instead, I use commitments and affirmations, and it's so much more powerful to use these. And we'll talk about affirmations in the second hour. But the trivia question, because we briefly enumerated this on Wednesday's show, is name one affirmation we talked about from the Midweek Update when substituting affirmations for resolutions. So if you think you have the answer, you can win one of three ways. You can call in to win, and that telephone number is 1-718-508-9002, 1-718-508-9002, and you can chat in to win, and I warn you, I am moderating the chat room, so it's difficult for me to talk and type at the same time. So what you need to do is have patience and bear with me so I can respond to you quickly. But if you do answer in the chat room, obviously it's ordered, so the first up with the potential correct answer will be the first one to win. And then finally, you can also win by simply sending us an email at trivia@uywradio.com. trivia at uywradio.com. So good luck. You could win my new book that just came out, But She Do Business, personalized to you or a friend or family member to whom you would like to give this to. You could win financial coaching, credit report review. You can win identity theft protection. You can win financial coaching. Did I say that one already? You can win tickets to an upcoming Top Gun seminar. So much to win, so little time to win it in. But if you want the edge on winning the trivia question, perhaps you haven't listened to the most recent broadcast, there is a way that you can get an edge on the competition. And I'll tell you how to do that simply by subscribing to our electronic magazine. All you have to do is go to our website, unlockyourwealthradio.com, drop your name in and become a subscriber, or just send us an email at ezine, E-Z-I-N-E, at uywradio.com, and we'll add you to our subscriber base. This comes out before the broadcast, so when you receive your electronic magazine, in addition to the tips, tricks, tools, and information it is filled with, also information about upcoming guests, your trivia question is found in this electronic magazine. So if you haven't had a chance to catch a previous broadcast, if you missed the download and weren't able to listen live, never fear, because you can take with the e-zine and listen to the broadcast and listen specifically for what the trivia question answer is. So again, today's question is, name one affirmation we talked about from this week's midweek update when substituting affirmations for resolutions, or substituting resolutions with affirmations. Did that make sense? Because I'm not sure it made sense to me. I am just so chomping at the bit. I'm filled with so much energy and enthusiasm about the new season, the new year. And for those of you who are into numerology, I'm half Romanian, so all of those heretical gypsy things that you're not supposed to believe in, I kind of sort of believe in them, because I'm afraid if I don't, that maybe something will happen. And so in numerology, I'm a master number 4. And so if you take the 2 plus the 1 plus the 1, that equals 4. So this should be my year. So I'm all excited about that. Anyway, just a little heretical side note for those God-fearing Christians that are listening. Anyhow, I'm so glad to have you joining us. Welcome to Season 8. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I am she, your money mentor, saying stay tuned for more coming up right after this.
Close more sales. Close more sales. Close more sales. Hi, this is Commander Marty Logan from the Top Gun Sales Academy. Are you the best salesperson you can be today? If not, allow us to help you to outpace your competition, your fellow peers, and recession-proof your business. Visit us at www.thetopgunseminars.com, 480-626-5883. Don't make excuses. Make it happen.
Hi, this is Scott Black with EmpowerU.net. You're listening to Heather Wagenhalls on Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
There is a massive tax storm coming next year. Dozens of new taxes, rules, regulations, fees, and penalties are arriving. Even the storefront tax preparers are being monitored by the IRS. What can you do? Go directly to www.cohesivetax.com and sign up now for a free strategic tax plan, and you can survive the tax hurricane. That's www.cohesivetax.com.
This is John Nowicki with LCM Capital Management, where we are changing the way the world invests. What we do is create financial plans tailored to each individual's risk parameters and retirement goals while eliminating all the additional costs and hidden fees that are associated with money management. You can contact me, John Nowicki, at LCM Capital Management at 312-705-3013. And look forward to a happy, healthy retirement with low costs and low fees.
Have you seen commercials for agencies that want to charge you a fee to settle your debt? Did you wonder if you could trust them? My name is Kenny Goldie, and I'm here to tell you don't need to pay anyone to settle your credit card debt. You can call your bank directly and do it yourself for free. How do I know? I did it. I reduced my own credit card debt from over $200,000 to zero, and I want to tell you how in my book, The Do-It-Yourself Bailout. Visit SettleYourCreditCards.com. My readers have settled nearly $1 million in credit card debt by themselves, no agencies, no fees, and you can too. Go to SettleYourCreditCards.com and read The Do-It-Yourself Bailout.
Everyone, welcome back to the broadcast. You're listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, and I am she, your hostess, with the financial mostess. And have you auditioned for today's Millionaire Makeovers? We will be kicking those off shortly. So get your application video style in. And tell us what you think you need to do with your money and how we can help you with some financial coaching. It is a well over $1,000 value package if you are selected to be a part of our program. Plus, you get featured on the show. How cool is that? Simply go to unlockyourwealth.com for more details on participating in our radio broadcast. Well, I am so excited that my buddy Deanie Weenie, it's so great. We have been friends for, 10, 12 years now. It's been such a long time, and, you know, we were cohorts in mortgages together, and then I jumped the fence to real estate, and he's been servicing all of my real estate customers financially for over a decade, and I'm thrilled to have him on the phone. It's so funny, when we call each other, we don't refer to each other by our first names. I always say, hey, Wags, it's Wags. And vice versa. It's so funny. So anyway, he's a personal friend, and he appeared on last season, and he stopped by to talk about the state of Mortgage America. And this season, he's popping by for a couple of reasons. I'm so excited. One of which, he is the financial coaching star of the hit reality show on WeTV, Downsized, where he provides financial coaching to a family in financial distress. Dean is also a leading expert in consumer finance and housing with over 16 years of experience. And he's developed the reputation of someone who knows the answers to tough questions. Dean is a member of over 25 financial organizations, a certified consumer credit counselor, has spoken to over 3,000 people facing foreclosure and addressed the media on this topic over 500 times, including cover stories in USA Today and appearing on CNBC's On the Money. As one of the few mortgage originators certified by the state of Arizona to teach realtors refresher courses for license renewal exams, Wagner wrote a 255-page guidebook. I'm so excited because it's brand new. On the Arizona Real Estate Sales Exam, and he also shares his expertise as a business coach for 4 years with the Core Training Inc. He also has a brand new book about facing foreclosure. So please welcome to the broadcast my dear friend and mortgage expert, Dean Wagner. Welcome to the broadcast, Dean. How are you?
I'm doing great, Heather. Thank you for having me, as always.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you back. It's a new year, and we're talking about new yous, financially speaking. And you've got so much going on. It's so exciting. And I'd like to catch all of our regular listeners up on your activities, because in addition to your television show, you also have a book out. And I'd like to catch up our new listeners who are looking to turn over a new leaf, and especially a foreclosure leaf. And you've got a great book out now, Life After Foreclosure. And the last time we talked with you, you were in the process of filming this incredible TV show. Can you tell us a little bit about the show?
Yeah, the show's been a success. It's called Downsized. It's a reality show on WeTV, which is Women's Entertainment Network. And it's amazing. It's really the contrast from a family of nine that went from high class to poverty level in a matter of 24 months. And the dynamics, because they're still in denial and they still have the same routines and habits as they did before, without the realization that they're just losing almost $2,000 a month and borrowing money from their children. And so there's a lot of contrast there. The dynamics, the contrast, everything about the show has just been so entertaining for people, and as a result, it's been a hit.
So give some examples that we can see on the show when we watch the episodes, and I believe it's on WeTV, is that correct?
Yes, it is, Women's Entertainment Network.
Now, you see, and I do too all the time in our financial coaching practices, some of the same mistakes. But what did you see, like a family of nine, so we've got, what, seven kids and two parents? Is that what we're dealing with?
Exactly. And six of the seven kids are in high school because three of them are twins. And this was two families that were merged together in a marriage. And so he had two, she had five. And so they've got six high school kids, and it's just, you know, it's a crazy show, I got to tell you that.
So it's a Brady Bunch dynamic.
It is, yeah. You know, they had divorces in the past. They had bankruptcies and foreclosures. They had all the struggles that everyone in America is going through, and I think that's why the show's a hit, because so many people can relate in one way, form, or another to what the Bruces, that's the name of the family, the Bruces, everyone can relate to what they've gone through or are going through.
Well, having just a family struggling financially is one thing. Now we're dealing with blended families, so that makes another even more interesting dynamic. Tell us about a couple specific instances that you dealt specifically with them that you have seen recur in your financial coaching with other people. What are some of the same mistakes that people make?
Well, the biggest mistake is people get excited about something and they implement it, and then about 45 days later they forget, you know, what they were committed to doing, and they go back into their old. And so to really have change, you got to have commitment and follow through, and you got to go through some pain. I mean, if that pain means you don't eat out for, you know, 90 days or 6 months or whatever it is, you're not eating out. You know, you're going to eat home-cooked meals, and you're going to cut back as much as possible. And that's the biggest mistake, is people go back and go, I can't, you know, I'm just not going to live that lifestyle. I'm going to live above my means, and if I have to borrow to do it, borrow against my future, put it on credit, I'm going to go ahead and do that because, you know what, everybody else is doing it, and so it's okay for me.
So where do you think that bandwagon approach comes from? Well, if everybody else is doing it, I'm doing it too. Where do you think that comes from?
Heather, it's really easy. The American consumer is sold through different various types of advertisements and marketing. We're sold on average about 5,000 times a day, Heather. So, yes, we can say no 4,999 times. It only takes that one time to get back in debt or overextend ourselves or expose ourselves. That's the problem, and that's the shift that we need to work on. We're not going to change the marketers, because I'll tell you this right now, Heather, in a year from now, there's going to be 6,000 times a day you're going to get hit with advertisements. You're not going to change that. What you got to change is the household, the person, the personal beliefs, the commitments that they made to themselves, that I'm not going to overspend. You know, a great rule of thumb that I like to tell people is, you know, if you've got, say, let's just say, for example, $300 a month to spend on just blowing on stupid stuff, that's 10 bucks a day. Well, if something's 15 bucks, you know, you can't spend it. You got $10 a day to spend. And so that's called, you know, the level, I call it the commitment level, but if you're committed, you're not going to do that. And I like that word a lot, commitment, because when you're really committed to changing and improving your situation, you're not going to overextend yourself.
I agree. I just think about simple things like setting appointments with people, and you say, well, do you think you'll be there? And they go, oh, yeah. And then they totally miss their appointment. But if you ask somebody, well, will you commit to this time? All of a sudden, there's a different level of engagement when you make a commitment versus just saying, oh, I need to be better at this, or I'm not going to do that anymore. That's the key word, I think, is commitment level. And one of the things that I've found is unless somebody is committed to making a change financially, you'll just, you know, barf on them until you're blue in the face with advice and information and overcoming all of their objections. But unless they're committed to changing and truly succeeding financially, you're not going to get anywhere with them. What do you think keeps people from starting?
Well, they don't know where to begin. It's just too much information, and it's just like, you know, how do you eat an elephant? Well, you're not going to eat it all in one chunk. You got to eat it at one bite. And, you know, if you and I sat down to eat an elephant, we probably wouldn't know where to start. You start on a hoof, or do you eat an ear, or what? So you need that direction. And so a lot of times it's like, what is the first step? And, you know, I like the personal budget. I think that's the first part, because until you know exactly how much money's coming in and how much money's going out, you can't benchmark. You can't start chipping away. You know, prescription without diagnosis is malpractice. And so when you sit there and you go, you know, I listen to these other professional finance experts, and I listen to their call-in shows, and it's like they start prescribing, and they haven't even heard the patient's diagnosis, you know, the symptoms, what is going on. And so, like, when they just start blurting out this information, it's like, you got to listen. You know, a good financial planner really listens to these people. And, you know, why are they spending too much? Is it the habit? Is it the spender's high? Is it emotional? Do they do it to fill themselves up? I mean, you know, right now, we can go into a lot of consumers' closets, and 50% of their items are still brand new. They bought that stuff just to make themselves feel good, because it was about that day, that moment, that time in their life that they needed to get that emotional fulfillment. Well, guess what? Now it's setting them back 5, 10, 15 years from retiring or having a substantial life, because they're emotionally inept and they're filling themselves up with these acquisitions that they can't afford. This is a downward spiral that, you know, we got to help people and educate them that there's other ways to fulfill your life. Spending money that you don't have is not a way to fulfill your life. But, you know, people have gambling addictions and drug addictions and alcohol addictions. There is such a thing as a spending addiction. And unfortunately, there's not a lobby group or money to be made off of these people, because guess what? They spent all their money. You know, they're going down the toilet, and we got to help them. But 72% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, Heather. We got to reach out to those people and help those people, because we got to get through this together.
Well, you're right. The average person is 2.5 paychecks away from homelessness. Homelessness. And that's a scary statistic. So,
yeah, well, I just heard a statistic. There's almost 5 million people homeless in America right now. And if you count people living with relatives that are displaced from their previous home, the average age of the homeless person in America right now, Heather, is 25 years old. And almost 1.5 million homeless people are under the age of 18. There is a shift going on in our country right now. There's 42 million people on food stamps. We got to help these people.
Well, where do you think we start? Because it's easy to say we got to help these people, but where do you start when, like the Bruces, they're in denial?
Well, I think it's an entire shift. It's an American culture shift. And one thing that's coming out of this recession is people, and shows like Downsize, is people are starting to look at their finances. You know, people would rather talk about their sex life than their financial life when it comes to, like, an open forum. And so we're opening it up where you can talk about, hey, you know what, I make 40 grand a year. I got 10,000 in credit cards. My car payment's 450. It's always been, never tell people your business. Well, guess what? It's time to start talking about your business, because we're going to learn from each other. But I'll tell you, the biggest shift has to start with our youth. We have to start installing financial literacy to the youth in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. And we're not going to hammer them with, like, federal deficits and GDP and things like that. But you can talk about, you know, the basics. Hey, you made $10 on your allowance. If you save $3 and you're allowed to spend $7, if you can keep that up, you can retire at age 52 with, you know, $4 million in the bank, and it'll pay you interest, and you don't have to work, and you can live the American dream. The American dream has been shattered, Heather. They told you to go to college. Well, guess what? The average career is 5 years. The average college graduate will have six careers in their lifetime, six career changes. They told you to buy a house. Well, guess what? One in three Americans are upside down in your house. You know, they tell us all these things to do, but none of it's panning out. What is the American dream anymore, Heather? What is it? You know, I mean, that's my question to everybody. What's going on?
I think it's still the same thing. If you want me to give you my perspective or a blanket answer to your question, I think that the American dream is still alive. I think that our parents, and especially those in the boomer generation, took and did not effectively teach our children, meaning you and I, our brothers and sisters, and those older than us, how to achieve. They crippled us by giving us, oh, well, I want my kids to have what I didn't have. Well, really? Because that shot their character. So we have people that are out there that operate with very little or no character. The American dream isn't shot. It's the tactics in which people went around to achieving them. They didn't understand delayed gratification. They didn't understand the appropriate way to approach all of those things. It's not the flaw isn't with the American dream. Shame on people for buying houses that they're upside down in. If they didn't do their homework, if they didn't look at the market. I called this on my radio show in 2003, and I said that the mortgage bubble was going to be bigger and more massive and more devastating than any real estate bubble ever on the planet. And I was right. And it's because the median home price and the median income got in disparity. They weren't an achievable, workable number. But people didn't care, and they sold their integrity, and they went out and said, I don't want to delay my gratification for this American dream. I don't want to work hard like my parents, because why? Because my parents told me not to. My parents said that my life should be better than theirs, so their standard of living was what these kids came up and assumed was theirs, and it wasn't, because it's what their parents had earned. And so then they didn't know how to do anything but go out and take, and that's how they went forth into the world. So instead of earning and making their way, they chose to charge and take their way. And they're having to deal with the ramifications of that. Unfortunately, because people sometimes think I'm pretty harsh on this, unfortunately, it's affecting all of us. Because
yeah.
What happened to the guy? Where's the compassion for the guy who did the right thing, who saved up, who bought his house at the right price, put 20% down? What about that guy who continues to make his mortgage payment even though he's underwater, as opposed to taking the easy way out and walking away and defaulting on their homes deliberately just because they're underwater?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just taking and saying, you know what, to heck with the commitment. Yeah, I made a commitment to you to pay this loan off in 360 installments. However, since it's not worth what I bought it, screw you. Really?
You know, it's interesting, Heather, because, you know, I wrote that book, Life After Foreclosure, and we do address that, because that's that moral dilemma that so many Americans are struggling with. And I agree with you. Hey, I signed for 30 years, and if the house went up, I'd still be paying. Just because it went down doesn't mean I get to stop paying, you know, and get off the hook. But you're right, a lot of people are having it. But what about this argument, Heather? I mean, if it happened to 100,000 people, I get it. But it's happening to 20 million Americans. I mean, do you think 20 million Americans were that naive? I mean, was it under their control, or was this something that was beyond their control? And honestly, I come from the angle, well, guess what? I don't think you should be upside down in your house a third of your adult lifetime. I don't think you shouldn't be punished and not be able to move for 10 to 15 years while you wait for your house just to get back to even. You know, when you signed that paperwork, it said remedy for default, which said the most you can lose is your home. So guess what? I'm electing to no longer pay. If I stop paying, you take my house. I'm going to sit it out for 36 months, and I'm going to go buy me a bargain at current market value, because I can buy a house in 3 years after my foreclosure. And that's a right that you addressed when you signed that mortgage contract. And your lender knew it. You knew it, that there was remedies for default in place. So I understand that moral dilemma. But I don't like when, you know, you have two houses side by side, One guy throws in a towel. The other guy sticks it out. The guy that throws in a towel buys the house, let's say, on the same block in 3 years. And in 15 years from now, one guy's got $20,000 in equity. The other guy has $220,000 in equity. The guy with $220,000 can retire a full 5 to 10 years younger, while the other moral guy is punished and can't retire and has to work longer because they had to stick with their obligation. I disagree with that. You know what I'm saying? I think if you know your rights and you sign paperwork accordingly, hey, if you're going to spend 10 years upside down in a house, I say, you know, do the math. What works for you is what works for you. But that's my angle from it, Heather. So,
well, here's the thing, though, and I don't have an issue. I'll make it clear. I don't have an issue with people that make a business decision to walk away financially. But I'll guarantee you, the guy that goes around the corner and buys the bargain 3 years later is going to use his home as an ATM, and he's going to put himself in the exact same spot he was in because he hasn't addressed what caused that problem to begin with. You know, people keep talking about equalization and, you know, you tax the rich and you redistribute. But if you took all the money away from the rich people right now and gave it all to the poor, I guarantee you in less than 5 years, the poor will be poor again and the rich will have it all again. Why? Because of how they function, the integrity and the discipline that they operate with. I don't begrudge anybody. I just want to stimulate interesting conversation. I don't begrudge anybody for taking that road if they choose to walk away. But here's the challenge that we have is this societal problem. That's the moral dilemma, because we have taught our children and they're teaching their children to operate without integrity. That moral dilemmas are not a consideration. Safety is an afterthought. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and I respect that. And, you know, I think when you're looking in terms, if you're writing the book about America and the future of our country, I think, you know, I think we both agree, like, financial literacy is a must in educating people from not making the same mistakes. Our government's taking the approach with the Bureau on Consumer Financial Protection that comes out this summer that's going to regulate mortgages and servicing and everything. I mean, the regulation that's coming in place on new mortgages is unbelievable. I mean, they completely remodeled that industry, and I'm going to say for the worse.
Didn't ask anybody within the industry what the flaws were.
No, they didn't. And here's the thing that I have a problem with is 18% of GDP relies on housing. Well, housing is, you know, fundamentally financed through mortgages. Well, they basically eliminated all the people that originate mortgages or loan officers. I mean, they hit them at the knees. They took them down, and they just put caps on everything that they're allowed to do. So they're going to see that years down the road. I don't think that's the right approach. And when you look at the money that was made off of this recession from mortgages, the originators was a very small little spectrum. In the spectrum, it was a sliver. The biggest was in the secondary market when they, you know, CDOs and credit default swaps and all that stuff, when they sold all that. That's where the trillions were made. You know, yes, some originators made some money, but taking out the foot soldiers that are going to prop housing back up, taking those people out is not the way our country, our government needs to handle it. They need to start teaching people in classes. You know, you have math and you have science. Why would you not have, you know, home economics 101 mandatory for everybody? That's the shift that has to occur.
Well, and here's the deal. It's an unfortunate occurrence. However, in the 90s, the late 90s, when we saw the subprime products coming out, when we saw the alternative qualifying products coming out, and these low-down or no-down loans that were credit score only based, not even on credit quality, you could get an 800 score after having a Victoria's Secret card open for only 6 months and just happen to have a zero balance on the day they pulled your credit, so you were able to get that high number. All of those foolish underwriting guidelines is the mortgage industry's fault. in the 90s, I worked very hard with a gentleman who passed away, Bill Slater, here in the state of Arizona, to get our industry to self-regulate. I was a big part of the Mortgage Lenders Association, and I also used to spend time with the Mortgage Brokers Association, which is a less than scrupulous bunch of folks at the time. Those were the ones that were really pushing all of those other alternative products. But the Mortgage Lending Association said, oh, things are fine. We don't need to self-regulate, until underwriting guidelines got looser than, you know, a tadpole's pair of underwear. And the challenges with the industry were brought upon themselves because they chose not to self-regulate, and because they wouldn't create even a level of ethics or standards to stick by to ensure loan officer qualification. I mean, the only thing I had to do, after being a stockbroker, I had to have an FBI check, I had to pass this monstrous exam, and every transaction that I executed, every trade was monitored. And then I came over to the mortgage industry. I didn't have to take a test. I didn't have to get fingerprinted. I didn't have to give a background check. The only thing that the mortgage company I went to work for, the first one, required of me is that I had less than $50,000 worth of charge-offs on my credit report.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
It's nuts.
Because they just want to make sure that I wasn't desperate and I wasn't going to make inappropriate decisions. There was no licensing requirements. There was no testing in place. There was no recourse for individual loan officers. The mortgage company had to go down for that, so why would anybody want to open up a mortgage company? To take a quick hit and get out? Well, that's what happened. You got all these unscrupulous people that joined the industry because it wasn't regulated. And the industry itself is dealing with the ramifications of not self-regulating, you know, more than 12 years ago when I was in the industry, and I was crying for it. I was going to the legislators, and I'm like, let's craft some loan officer accountability legislation. I can't tell you the numerous letters that I wrote to all of my state senators and state representatives saying, we need to do something about this. And I kept going and going, and nobody was interested because everybody was making money. Uh-huh. And nobody wanted to disrupt the flow of the machine. And I'm like, but real estate agents have to be licensed. This is different. You know, I understand with a stockbroker, you have a responsibility to the money that you take in. But with mortgages, I feel like there's a bigger fiduciary responsibility. You have to be careful about the money that you're lending out.
Absolutely. But
most loan officers were advocates of the customer, and they were cheering on the wrong person by forging bank statements and allowing them to go all day and saying they were commissioned when they were truly salary and all of this stuff. You know, I mean, they were advocating for the wrong side of the fence. And
yeah.
That's what kind of really spurred it on, and with the industry refusing to self-regulate, that's why we got the bag of moldy oranges that we did, because it's their fault. So, like, while it's frustrating as somebody who may want to buy property in the future to have to go through a totally different, more arduous, and certainly as a result of the bureaucracy, more costly mortgage process, the industry got what it deserved because it refused to self-regulate.
Correct. Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, I think that's a valid insight. I do. And as you know, the mortgage business is not a billion dollar, it's a trillion-dollar industry. I mean, the reason we're in this recession is over mortgages, and not just mortgages. These are American mortgages, and it created a global epidemic. Last I heard, there was 8 countries lost their governments over American mortgages. AIG, insurance giants, went out over mortgages. People need to think there's a lot more to mortgages than just, you know, your home loan and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This is a global trillion-dollar epidemic, and the main reason is because the 90-year history of mortgages is that they've always performed. There's always less than a 2% default rate. They've never depreciated. Home prices have never depreciated except for twice in the last 90 years, and that was minimal, less than 1% each time, that they went and they parlayed this into thousands of financial species or products that they made trillions of dollars off. I mean, why is it that there's almost $500 trillion in derivatives when there's only about $12 trillion in mortgages in America? I mean, they've just taken this mortgage concept of this fixed income, this fixed payment, and parlayed it into $500 trillion worth of derivatives or byproducts from the American paying his bills every 30 days thinking it just goes to your local bank. Well, guess what? It doesn't go to your local bank. It goes all over the world.
And, you know, it makes me think of that movie, Tommy Boy. And when you remember in Tommy Boy, when he first started getting his feet kind of, you know, his legs underneath him, and he was starting to really get the sales process kicking in. And I think about, when I think about collateralized mortgage obligations and some of these credit default swaps and these just out of thin air products, I think of when the guy was saying, well, you know, he wanted that little guarantee on there, and Tommy Boy was saying that it didn't matter, you know, you could, that gives you like those warm, fluffy, good feelings that, oh, I have a guarantee, I can go to bed, I can sleep well at night. But he says, if I crap in a box and put that on, is that going to make you feel better? Does it change if there's still crap in that box? No, it doesn't.
Why do they put a guarantee on the box then? Because they know all they sold you was a guaranteed piece of shit. That's all it is, isn't it? Hey, if you want me to take a dump in a box and mark it guaranteed, I will. I got spare time.
So if I crap in a box, but I put a pretty label on it and a fancy sticker, it still doesn't change that I just crapped in a box. And that's what those collateralized mortgage obligations are. That's what those credit default swaps on all of those alternative products. You know, if somebody has a credit score that's in the toilet, that's a statistical rate of default that says, not if I'm going to default, it's when I'm going to default.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so let's talk about life after foreclosure. Forget about whether it's a moral dilemma or not. It's going to happen, and it has happened for millions of Americans already. So you wrote a practical guide to recovery after losing your home. Where did your inspiration to create this book come from?
You know, Heather, I've been fortunate to do a lot of housing commentary. I'm a certified consumer credit counselor, and as a result, I've been in front of the media now probably close to 1,000 times over the last 5 years. And whether it's, you know, print, paper, radio, or TV, or whatever interview it is. But what happens is afterwards, there's a lot of people reach out to me and go, Dean, I've researched all over the internet, and I cannot find answers anywhere about my situation. And I would talk to them about their situation, and they'd call me in 6 months and say, hey, you know what, you really helped me, and I got some direction. And then a year later, I'd hear from them, and they go, you know what, Dean, I'm totally out of that situation, or I've moved on, or I did this, or I did that. And it helped me, and, you know, and during that trying time, you were really the only voice that was there for me. And so what I've done is over the last couple of years, I've really been thinking about it, and there's just nowhere. I mean, people call radio stations or TV stations, and they're looking for anybody with any answers. I mean, my book is the only book of its kind that deals with the financial and emotional aspects of losing your home. And, you know, it's very personal when people lose their home. It's embarrassing. You did it to your neighborhood. You feel like a dummy. Why is it happening to me? You're questioning yourself, and you're looking back, and you blame others. It hampers your relationship with your spouse and your children, your work. I mean, it affects every part of your life, just like a divorce or a death. But there's no book about it, you know? So that was the inspiration, was really to give back and help people and have something there to hold their hand during this entire time. And I love the reviews that we're getting, because so many people are like, Dean, it really helped me when I needed it. And I would pick up the book and read it, and it was there for me. And thank God there was a product to go through this, because otherwise you're completely on your own.
There were a couple chapters here that I thought were very insightful. And it's almost as if you listened to my radio show and took my lead, hint, hint.
Yes, exactly.
but, you know, in Chapter 6, you got children come first. How to spell love to a child. How do you spell that? How is love spelled?
It is spelled T-I-M-E. And I think a lot of people don't pay enough attention when you're with your child. I mean, you can be with your child or you can be with your child. And when you're being remember, we're human beings, not human doings. When you're actually being with your child, that means you're engaged. You're looking into their eyes. You see their little personalities. You hear what they're saying. You process their words. You're genuinely engaged in the conversation. Your body language, you're communicating with one another. Just because you're in the same room with your child doesn't mean that you're with your child. So it's really important to be present when you're with the child, especially when you're going through that foreclosure. You have got to carve out some time. You've got to sit down and explain to them what's happening and why you're moving. They know it. I mean, when 20, 25 million Americans are going through this, a lot of kids in school are talking about this. They're smart, and you just can't ignore it. And there's, you know, I explain how to address it in the book so you can talk to your kids, and it's a win-win for everybody.
Well, just like we endure the shame and the embarrassment, that's happening to them too on a different scale, possibly worse because, you know, adults aren't going to run down the street as you're moving your stuff out going, ha-ha, loser, you just got foreclosed on. But they will to your child. Your parents are broke. Your parents suck. You know, you're so lame. And then I think about the child themselves. You know, their room is like their whole world that shapes them. And their four walls are going to be forever changed. They'll never have another room like the one they're losing. They could put the same posters up. They can paint the rooms the same. But it's not. It's not the same.
I would say, you know, you got to explain to your kids the difference between a house and a home. You know, and this is just a house, and we're moving on, and our home is where our family is, and we're a family, and we're sticking through this together, and you come first. And, you know, you really got to emphasize how important that child is to them and the nucleus of the family sticking together. And don't worry about what kids say if they say things like, you know, about you losing your house. It's happening to a lot of people. It's beyond our control. And our home is where our family sleeps. A home can be anywhere. And you're right. It is personal to the child. I mean, this is something that just, I mean, but again, back to there's no other books or anything else on the market to address how do you approach children when it comes to losing your house. And so, you know, and I sat down with child therapists. I sat down with marital therapists when we wrote this. And it's short. You know, there's only a few pages when it comes to the talking to your children chapters. I didn't want to give like 25 pages. It's not a lecture. It's like these are the tactics that you can do to address it with your child. It's very practical. I mean, the book's called Practical. The information's short. It's quick. And you can implement it.
And that's the key because – it is simple. You just have to take that first step when it comes to speaking with your children. So you don't need 25 pages. You just need to acknowledge that there is something that must be addressed. And then I think back to my Break the Budget Key and how I liken budgeting and dieting as something that you go onto and off of. And I always talk about creating a healthy savings and spending plan instead. And I've never seen anyone else except for one other guest that ever addressed exercise and nutrition as a key to financial health and wellness. And you have two chapters, one on exercise and one on nutrition. And I think that that's amazing. What made you decide to include those two chapters in your book?
You know, I'm fortunate to be able to affiliate myself with some quality therapists. And there's one in particular in Canada, and he does a four-day program that deals with personal development. And a good portion of it, I would say almost a third, involves physical exercise. And there's an emphasis on yoga, dancing, different dancing techniques, different body movements, walks in the park, meditations in nature, and it's almost metaphysical in a little bit of a way, Heather, but that emphasis on mind, body, and soul. You know, your mind, a foreclosure hits you mentally, but it affects you physically. So to combat the physical aspects, you got to exercise. And for some people, it's as little as just walking a half an hour a day or an hour a day. you know, not everybody's in this tip-top shape, but almost everybody can walk for a half an hour or an hour. And just by doing that as you're going through your foreclosure, that'll help you get through your foreclosure, because there's times when you're just so wound up that you have to unwind. Well, what you don't want to do is you don't want to unwind on your spouse or your kids or your employer or your mom or your dad or blaming others. So getting out there and doing that exercise, blowing off some steam, it clears your head. It's good for you. You start feeling better. You're breathing better. It opens up your lungs. There's so much positivity with dealing with stress when it comes to exercise, and that's why, first and foremost, it's definitely going to be in the book, Life After Foreclosure.
Well, I am so super thrilled that you chose to stop by our show yet again to engage me in some great verbal debate about the mortgage industry and our society. But more importantly, I'm so excited to have a copy of this book, Life After Foreclosure, for your first endeavor as an author. I'm so proud to know you, because this is a quality publication. It's not 1,000 pages of you blathering on about yourself like I've seen some of these other credit restoration books and stuff like that, where it's all just garbage. This is short and sweet, specific information, and it's so well-rounded because you take the time to not just talk about the financial aspect out of it. One of the things that people forget so much in this world is that we are not rational human beings that feel. We are emotional creatures that justify our behavior through logic and reason after the fact. If we were so fabulously logical and the men of reason, as Ayn Rand created all of our heroes to be, we would never be in this situation. And because we're emotional creatures, you did a wonderful job at touching on that important aspect of this whole process. It's just not a balance sheet decision. It's so much more when it comes to yourself, your marriage, your spouse, and your health, not just your financial wealth. So I'm so proud of you, and I'm so excited to have this book in my hands. Tell me where people can go to get a copy of your new book or see episodes of your TV show.
The best place to buy the book right now is going to be either on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you can buy it in traditional soft cover, or you can buy it on ebook, and both are available. And to check out the reality show Downsize, that's going to be on WeTV, and they'll be replaying that all the way through March of 2011, and that's Women's Entertainment Network, and the show's called Downsized.
What's your website, Dean, if people want to get a hold of you for some financial coaching or mortgage advice?
Absolutely. My website's going to be deanwegner.com, and that's spelled DEANWEGNER.
Thanks again for joining us, Dean. I'm Heather Wagenhals. You've been listening to the reality show Downsize star Dean Wegner on Heather Wagenhals Unlock Your Wealth Radio. We'll be right back with more after this.
Hey, this is Coca Brown from the hit radio show, The Truth with Coca Brown, on HollywoodOutlaws.com radio. And you're listening to me on Heather Wagenhals Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
Hi, it's Marty Logan here from the Top Gun Sales Academy. You know, one thing I've learned over the years is that the most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Naturally, Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, and Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside. They knew they could easily become. Truly, financial coaching could be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation. 1-866-966-9420. That toll-free number again is 1-866-966-9420, or simply visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and gun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power, or charge your device right on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, Industries.com. Like, go there, totally!
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagonhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagonhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You've been listening to Dean Wagner on Heather Wagonhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I am she, your purveyor of prosperity, with Sonero, our prosperity poochie here. And, yeah, you can't run back to the studio when you play a commercial and expect your dog not to chase you. Anyway, wasn't that a great conversation? I always love that. He's so forceful and so passionate when he talks, and I just think that that's so great. I just adore my friend Dean. So thanks so much for joining us, Dean. 9 credit card scams. Let's talk about some minutes on your money real quick before our next guest joins us. We can lower your rate. The caller gives you good news is you can get a lower rate on your interest card, but there's usually an upfront charge, so pay attention to that. How about the fake freeze? You know, these are interesting. You get an emergency text that there's a problem with your account, that your card has been frozen and you need to call this number, but when you telephone, you're prompted to enter your card number and other information, and what's really going on is the crooks are collecting your data. How about the number 3-digit con? You get a call from your credit card's issuing bank. They have some problems with security. They've noticed unusual charges. They need to confirm your info. The real purpose of the call is to get your security number on the back. The clue, it says, when they're asking for your information, that's always a bad sign that they may even have some of your data already, which means they might have bought it from somebody online or gone dumpster diving to come up with partial credit card numbers. How about free games, free music, and free porn? Yes, you might have a keystroke logger if you go for these, quote, free things. And the way to protect yourself is keep a security program updated, and it's done automatically and regularly when you download it in the background. How about come to our spoof website? You get an email from your bank, purportedly, PayPal or your favorite store. There's a problem with your account, security breach, your order's ready, whatever it is, and just click this link to get more info to pay for your order. And they are collecting your data. So watch out for that. So, we've got so much in store, and it looks like our next guest is in. So let's bring on Robert Geniac. He's the owner of Tanak & Associates and is the author of the international bestseller Rich is a State of Mind. It's a novel about personal finance as seen through the eyes of a humorously dysfunctional family. With an entertaining yet direct speaking style at seminars across North America, Robert also offers a lighthearted look at financial planning with the serious message of personal responsibility. Could that play into this week's key of acceptance and affirmation, perhaps? Audience loves his dynamic and engaging presentation with challenges, which challenges them to see things from a different perspective. Robert has been a student of the financial planning process for almost 2 decades, and his goal is to passionately encourage people to take control of their finances in order to have a richly imagined future.
Welcome to the broadcast, Robert.
Thank you very much for having me, Heather.
I'm so glad that you chose to participate in today's interview because your book, I think, is really, it's poignant and it really talks to what money and wealth is truly about, and it's not a big pile of money, is it?
No, it's not. At the end of the day, the numbers that show up in the bottom of a mutual fund statement or a 401k statement are not going to make people happy. It's going to be what they chose to do with the money and the experiences they had in their life over what that dollar value is.
Mm-hmm. Now, your book is fictional?
It's a hybrid. It's a fictional American family trying to come to grips with the concept of money and insurance and investing and what does it all mean. Yet at the end of the day, people who know me very well have picked out particular items from the book and said this was this, that was that, this location is where you grew up, and I'd say absolutely correct. But the family at the heart of the story is a composite of a lot of people I know, but it's nobody in particular.
Mm-hmm. How fun. So, you know, what I think is interesting as you chose to write this book is that rich is a state of mind is not from a financial analyst point of view. It's kind of your customer side of the approach. Is that, do I have that right?
That's a very fair statement. I've never been a financial advisor. I've never worked for a financial services company. I've been a client of the financial services industry for about two decades. And so when I decided to write the book, the only position I could write it from was from that of a client. And so when I did that, I wanted to make sure that people understood that personal finance is not complex as many people think it is, nor should it be, but that the perspective I wrote from was from that of the client trying to come to grips with what is it I'm supposed to know, and more importantly, how do I deal with the emotions surrounding money?
Oh, you just hit on the key word, emotions. You know, we talk all the time on this show that we are not rational creatures, that we are emotional creatures that justify with reason and logic after the fact of usually poor decision making.
Oh, absolutely. And I tell people all the time, it's 2010 now. We're about to go into 2011. And what is it about money that is so emotional? It's pieces of paper with ink on it. It's metal they've pounded into coins. But there's something about this substance that makes people do things, A, they wish they hadn't, or sometimes want things that they really shouldn't based upon the monetary value of what they're carrying around in a wallet or purse.
Well, I don't think wants are the issues. We all have hopes, dreams, goals, and desires, but whether it's realistic to fulfill them at a certain income level is the question that most people don't answer correctly.
Well, I think the big problem today is in the past, there used to be a big line that you could draw between the want column and the need column. And right now, there's no such thing as want and need. Everything's need. Want has disappeared because want used to be the thing that we delayed gratification for. We took the time to save up the money. We didn't buy something until we had earned it. At least that's certainly the words that my parents would have used when I was younger. But now that concept has disappeared entirely, particularly for the 30 to 35 and under crowd, where everything has to happen today and has to happen now.
Well, yeah, who wants to wait till they're 60 to drive that Ferrari?
Well, but it's not even 60. If they're 23, it's waiting until they're 25. And what that leads us to do is oftentimes some very stupid would be too harsh, but we do some things with our money that not necessarily the smartest decisions we could have made. They make us feel better in the short term, but now you're finding people buried in credit card debt, almost unable to make the monthly payments, let alone dig themselves out of the hole. And what was it for? It was for a bunch of stuff that was supposed to impress people they didn't like that they spent money they didn't have to buy.
Mm-hmm.
I think Will Rogers said something to that effect. We spend money on things we don't want to impress people we don't like with money we don't have or something like
that. Yeah, absolutely. Very close to that, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, from a financial services customer perspective, what do you think is the biggest concern that we professionals on the other side of the fence are missing?
I think that the biggest thing that a financial services professional can do for their client is to stop them from doing exactly the wrong thing at exactly the wrong time. And over the last couple of years, we've seen huge swings in market valuations and 500-point drops in the Dow, followed by 200-point gains in the Dow. And the emotion surrounding me as a client and me representing clients who are listening to this show is that we drive around in our car, we listen to all this information, and the big question that comes back to us is, I'm ever going to have the financial future that I want for myself? And that's where the role of you as a professional becomes very, very key, to make sure that we make intelligent decisions, not emotional ones, and at the end of the day, to reassure us that the work that we're doing is actually going to get us where we want to go.
Mm-hmm. I think people tend to forget that just in general, and I like your answer about stop them from doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. I mean, you can always throw a dart at an investment and some will hit and some won't, but the best advice would be don't do the wrong thing at the wrong time. And I know, and mostly because I don't actively do financial services, I do mortgages, real estate, and personal financial coaching. So I'm on this other side of the fence, and when the market went to heck in a handbasket, the only thing that I did was send a text message to my broker, who's also my very dear friend, and I said, I love you, man. Four words. And I left him alone. And you know what? I wound up still doing double digits because I knew that I had picked quality investments and this was a hiccup, and I just wish I had more money at that particular moment to dump into the market when everything was at rock-bottom prices. I just doubled down, and I bought as much more so I could average my individual stuff down. And everybody's like, oh, my God, it's a terrible time. And I'm like, no, it's not. Get in the market. What are you thinking? Average down. And everybody else is mass panic, and they're freaking out. And probably because I'm on this side of the fence, I think that I have a little bit more intestinal fortitude than, say, just the general consumer. But I like your answer. Stop customers from doing the wrong thing at the wrong time, because those who chose to liquidate, I mean, I'm up huge as a result of my consistent investing over time, and I don't know what I'm in. I just give the money over and it goes, and that's what I wanted, because I used to be so into every single stock, watching its performance, because I used to day trade. Like, I didn't work for a year, and all I did was day trade until they changed the tax laws on us. And that was so much fun and so exciting, but it was grueling. You had to pay attention every day, and I don't want to have to do that. I just want to know that what I set forth as my financial goals for retirement, I can accomplish if I'm consistent over time.
No, and I believe that day trading takes a certain mentality and discipline that the vast majority of investors do not have, myself included. I could never handle the stress and the emotional roller coaster ride of doing that. And I remember as a younger investor myself, every Saturday I would, you know, go through the business section, you know, what is my mutual fund worth, what are the stocks worth, and, you know, keep track of it in numbers. And as I got better at it and more confident about it and realizing that, you know, this was a long-term scenario, I stopped looking every week and I stopped looking every month. I do pay attention, but I don't obsess about it anymore. And I think for the vast majority of people, that's one of the better decisions they can make, is stop trying to push the button on their computer that goes, what am I worth now? What am I worth now? What am I worth now? Realizing that at the end of the day, you know, go spend some time with your kids, go hug your wife, have a family dinner. What's your worth at 4:30 in the afternoon will have no difference about what you're worth at 7 o'clock at night. It's about the other things that we're choosing to do with our time.
Agreed. You got to get away from that, because, you know, it wasn't what was going on in the market. Now, I never got nervous because, you know,
I did my homework, and if it didn't work out, it didn't work out. But it didn't stop when the market closed, because then there was aftermarket trading. And then you still got to do research. And I, you know, I had a bunch of different methods going at once. And so it required me to be so involved, intimately.
And you could never turn yourself off.
Right. And I didn't want to. At the time, it was really exciting. Once they changed the tax laws and made it not so good for me anymore as a trader, and then it became, it wasn't so much fun because I had to watch my trades and, oh, my God, how many days have I held this? Holy cow, am I going to make this window? Is this stock going to support itself until I can get out of it? Yada, yada, you know. So when all of that changed and all of the roller coaster excitement for me, it wasn't stress for me, it was excitement for me, went away, and all that other stuff got commingled, and I'm like, eh, you know what, I still don't need to do this. That's why there's mutual funds.
One of the things that I often encourage people to do, particularly those who are kind of obsessing about the net worth and the market and where we're going, is the fact that reading the business news on a day-to-day basis really isn't that good for your financial health. That things like Bloomberg and the Fox Business Network and CNNBC, they've got 24 hours a day to fill with their time. The problem is there's only about 12 minutes worth of real news every day. And because they repeat it over and over and over, and they get 27 people to talk about the exact same 30 seconds of news, and you get 27 different opinions. As an investor, I sit here and go, like, you've got to be kidding. Nobody seems to have any idea what's happening. And the point that I always use was, you may remember back to May 6th of this year, the Dow had the single biggest point swing in a single day in the history of the Dow. In that span of about 2.5 hours on that afternoon, it dropped almost 900 points. Mm-hmm. And the next morning, front page news across Canada and the U.S., the end is near. Dow plummets 900 points, largest single day drop. 8 days later, when the Dow closed 27 points higher than it had 8 days earlier, in other words, everything that was lost had been regained. Where was that story? It was on page 9 in about 3-point font, markets up on light trading.
Well,
so what happens
if it bleeds,
it
leads.
The financial press, I don't want to say their job is to scare people, but at the end of the day, how they report it really does influence how we react. And I use a line in the book that says, if what you're reading on a daily basis scares you about investing, stop reading.
Yeah.
And it's the best possible thing. I ask clients this when I do speaking engagements. How many of you stopped opening your financial statements 18 months ago? And you see hands nervously go up. And I go, hey, me too.
Congratulations.
I didn't need to see it. I knew what was in there. And all it was going to do was depress me. But here we are 18 months later, and guess what? The best possible thing I could have done with my advisor's advice, don't even open the statement. You don't need to see it. You know it's not good. But that's okay, because where we're going this year, next year, 5 years out, it's going to be okay because we've done the right thing and planned and charted a prudent course.
Yes, and I think that more confidence needs to be placed in the quality of your due diligence in selecting your financial advisor up front, and understand that all markets are cyclical and all markets go up over time. So,
and it's a case of making sure that your investment philosophy and how you choose to structure it with your advisor both fits your emotional kind of life cycle and where your goals are. And that's the one thing where I think investors sometimes fall down. If you ask, what is it you want out of your investing strategy? Well, I want more money. Okay, for what? Well, what do you mean? Well, what do you want the money for? Well, stuff. What kind of stuff? And until you can get them to write their goals down and very clearly delineate what it is they're trying to accomplish, the concept of having more money is really irrelevant, because you don't know how much more you need. And I tell people all the time, if your goals are such that you could meet everything you ever wanted to do by earning 2% on your money, don't go in the stock market. There's no need for you to be there. because you're going to get everything you want without the stress and the aggravation. Also, the flip side is, if what you want requires a 47% annual compounded return for the next 23 years, okay, you better relook at the goals, because that's not going to happen.
Right. No, that's wonderful insight, because so many people don't have goals, and so they don't know what they need, and so they're in the market without some significant direction, and the stress is self-induced. It's not that their broker is doing or not doing a good job, but without specific direction and knowing what it is that you need to end up with, that's half the battle.
You know, it's like the old adage, if you don't care where you end up, any road will take you there.
For sure.
You know, but when it comes to investing, then it becomes much more of a interesting issue where, you know, you've got to have these goals, you've got to have a little bit of direction, and at the end of the day, working with an advisor to chart that course is very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. You know, I want to talk about personal responsibility in a minute, but as a customer, what do you think that is the one piece of advice that all financial customers never take?
The one piece that they never take would be the fact that they have belief that tomorrow is going to be different than today if they're just willing to be patient enough to wait for tomorrow to get here.
And you know what? Tomorrow never comes, because by the time it's here, it's today again.
Absolutely. So we have to keep looking out at that future, thinking that it's really going to be okay. But at the end of the day, we tend to, as humans, make incredibly short-term based decisions that affect the future of where it is we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the thing we do the worst as investors, because then we make incredibly irrational decisions that have a really negative impact on decisions that should actually be quite easy, that lead us to a better future.
Where do you feel personal responsibility is met or not met by individuals?
I think that we have a personal responsibility to lead our behavior in such a way that we're making smart decisions for ourselves, that we're true to what it is we say that we want to accomplish. Oftentimes, when I talk to clients or advisors about their clients, they tell me that too many of the clients say they want X, but they're walking in the direction of Y. And so what they, you know, the kind of the old adage, do as I say, not as I do. So they say that's what they want, but then when you push them on why aren't they making better financial decisions, you find out that what they say they want is what somebody else told them they should want, that it wasn't actually their decision. They've adopted somebody else's goals or directions. And I think that's the one thing. It's really hard sometimes for us, myself included, because I fall victim to this too, of admitting to ourselves what it is we really want. Because sometimes we do that and we go, if that's what I really want, then I've got to change my behavior to get it. Well, I don't want to change my behavior, so then I'll change what it is I want, when in reality, that's a difficult thing to do. But changing behavior is difficult as well. So we can get ourselves in a vicious downward cycle that's sometimes very difficult to get out of, Heather.
Well, yeah, because, you know, that whole decision-making process is based on conditioning and patterning from people that influenced our lives early on, our parents and our peers. And if we don't actively challenge that, then we just kind of plod along the same path, perhaps expecting different results, but using the same behaviors and patterns.
And this is an area where I think that the educational system across North America, and we're as guilty of this up here in Canada as well, is we don't teach kids anything about personal finance and money. We leave that to be done in the home because that's one of those emotional issues that schools don't want to touch. And so what happens is...
They'd rather talk about sex than money.
Oh, absolutely. Much easier to talk about that. Heck, let's show them videos in class. But when it comes to money, we'll leave that to the home. Now, if in the home you grew up in, your parents were good with money, then statistically, odds are very good that you'll make good decisions with money too, because you pattern yourself after the role models you saw. But for parents that weren't good with money and were always living paycheck to paycheck and sometimes not making great financial decisions, those get imprinted on the kids because parents cannot teach their children something they don't know. So what happens is those children sometimes, and even at university level, you graduate, you go across the stage, you get the little hat, you've got your diploma in your hand. Just as you're walking off the stage, there's somebody from a credit card company is saying, hey, graduate, here's your first credit card. No, absolutely no instruction manual about how to use this properly. And then 4 years later, they find themselves buried in $15,000 or $18,000 or $23,000 of consumer debt with no idea of A, how they got there, or B, how they're going to get out of it. And I think that does graduating students and young people across North America a great disservice.
Well, and financial literacy is so important, yet, like you said, it's the one thing that our school systems aren't willing to address, but it's even easier to teach than sex education. I mean,
well, I certainly think it should be easier to teach. The elemental basics are not that complex. Things like goals, compound interest, the nature of money, how do you earn money, how do you save it, how do you have more of it later. Definitely not complex topics. So I don't necessarily understand the emotion of why the school and education systems aren't spending more time teaching it. They teach us how to be good employees. They teach us the skills to make money. But they don't necessarily teach us the skills of what to do with it once we've got it in our hands.
Mm-hmm. And I still think that there's some vilification of rich people or what wealth means or entails. And I remain dug in with my opinion that money is only a magnifying glass. If you're a good person and do great things, money will expand that. If you are not so good, money is going to expand that.
Well, I think that's a great point that you make there, Heather. And at the end of the day, I often tell people money is a crappy way to keep score in life. But for many people, that's the only scorecard they use, mm-hmm. is how am I doing financially? And there's an example I use a lot that says if you're standing in the middle of the road and you're looking at a house and it's a two-story brick house, a couple of BMWs in the driveway. You see mom and dad and a couple of cute kids come out the door, and you kind of go, yeah, these guys got it all together. And you look at that house across the street and you go, I wonder how they're doing. A little bit older car in the driveway. They should probably redo the roof, maybe paint the windows. But I'm sure they're doing okay. You come back to the same spot a year later, and there's for sale sign on the really nice house because one of them lost their job and the leased BMWs are back to the leasing company. The kids are out of the private school and they're now downsizing their life because they didn't own a single thing. They had built a lifestyle funded on other people's money. And you look at that house across the street again, it's got its new roof and the windows have been painted. And there's a slightly newer car in the driveway, but not brand new. You go up and you knock on their door and you go, how you doing? Only to find out from their kids that, mom and dad are down at Arizona at their timeshare where they spend 3 months so they don't have to sit in the snow up in Michigan or Minnesota. But mm-hmm. they had decided a long time ago they didn't need to show anybody how they were doing. And at the end of the day, which one of them has a better life?
Oh, no question. No question. And somewhere along the way, our parents helped the media to reinforce that message that, by golly, you're entitled to it, whether or not you've earned it.
Yeah, and Madison Avenue and the marketing folks that create all the great TV and print ads have done a wonderful job at convincing us if we're not wearing the right perfume, driving the right car, drinking the right brand of beer, we're just not hip, you know, or we're not it. And your life will suffer if you choose not to consume these products. And,
right.
But it's interesting when you talk to people who are really financially successful, and by that I don't mean people who've got, you know, $8 million in the bank. I'm talking about people who make smart, prudent financial decisions on an ongoing basis. They completely ignore what goes on in the advertising agencies' boardrooms and with the material they create, because they're true to themselves and their decisions, not what other people tell them they should want.
And I think that the one thing that people always lose sight of is that wealth comes from within. It's not something that you can attain by looking a certain way or smelling a certain way or driving a certain car. Your arrival has to do with what's behind the eyeballs, not what's
driving. Absolutely. There's a line I used in the book when the characters are discussing the concept of what does rich really mean, and one of them throws out the word freedom. And it was kind of an interesting word for the group that was having the discussion, because two of them immediately said, freedom from what? And the Richard
not
was
freedom
the mentor.
Not freedom from, freedom of, in my
exactly.
Book.
Freedom to. Freedom to do the things you want to do with the people you want to do them with when you choose to do them. It's not a freedom from. It's the freedom to make the choices in life that you want for yourself and for the people in your life that you love.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that is the key. And we have to overcome so much of this stigmatism or programming. I know that money didn't grow on trees, because I heard it like 50,000 times, you know? And what do I look like? Do I look like I'm made of money? And I'm like, yeah. Can I have a couple fingers?
Do you think we have a money tree in the backyard that just...
Yeah. And I was working. I mean, I've been working since I was 11 years old. My mom had me out there because it was just me and my mom and my brother. And so she put me to work early. My brother was a couple years younger, and he was the good son. I was the bad kid, so.
Well, I was the only child, and as such, I understand the concept of being the black sheep within the family structure, which is tough when you're an only child.
Yeah, because you're the only sheep.
but I'd like to think that as I've gotten a little bit older and refine some of my decision-making processes, at the end of the day, I think Mom and Dad would admit they're probably kind of proud about how it all turned out.
Well, pride isn't the issue. I'm still the black sheep. It's like, no matter what I do, and I do so much more for my mother than my brother does, and it just, like, I'm like, can't I just get some recognition? She'll tell all these people, oh, my daughter's so great, blah, 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 but then she argues with me, and I'm like, how does that work?
The one thing I have found is sometimes people that we give the hardest time to are the people we have the highest expectations of. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And so maybe that's what your mom's doing, is her expectation level of you are that high because she knows that you can accomplish that. That sometimes it looks like she's giving other people a free ride.
Yeah, and his name is Robert. That's who got the free ride.
I'm sure he's a fine man because he shares the same name I do.
Yeah, oh, he is. He's a lieutenant colonel in the Army. So he's fabulous. He's getting ready to get deployed in a couple weeks. So he's a wonderful man, and he's a great American, and he's a soldier, and he's my baby brother. So I take personal credit for his professional career because, you know, had I not beaten him up every day until he grew bigger than me, he wouldn't have been tough enough to be in the Army. And he hates when I tell that story. He's like, don't say that to people. I'm like, well, you're not a mama's boy anymore, are you? So I love those conversations. But I think that people, you know, I think that people benefit when they understand that just word choice and perception can make all the difference. And I like how you titled your book, Rich is a State of Mind. How did you choose that title?
Well, unlike a lot of authors I've talked to who struggled with what to call their book when they were finished writing, I actually had the title before I ever wrote the first chapter. And I stumbled upon it one day doodling on a piece of paper, when I realized I was going to start writing the book and had finally made the decision to do so. And I've written kind of a page full of little notes and short little phrases. And I wrote down rich is a state of mind and put a circle around it and just kept coming back to that. Because at the end of the day, knowing that it's not money that's going to make you happy, it's everything else around it. And it was during a discussion I had with a friend of mine about the concept of money. And we know people, personally, Heather, that if they've got $20 in their pocket and they're walking down the street, they feel like the richest guy in town. And we know other people who might have a net worth of $1.4 million, but they lie awake in bed all night terrified that it's going to disappear. Which one of them is the richer person? And it all comes down to, for me, came down to what's going on in your head. Well, if it's what's going on in your head, well, state of mind is the natural extension of that. And the more I thought about it, the more I went, that's the phrase. That's the line I want to share with people. It's not the sum figure at the end of a bank statement or mutual fund report. It's what's going on inside your head that allows you to create the life you want.
Agreed. So in your book, Rich is a State of Mind, Building Wealth and Happiness, a Blueprint, Robert, what is the blueprint for wealth as you see it?
It's doing some smart, prudent, very basic things with your money over and over and over. I cycle back to the goals because I think that's the foundation for everything. Understanding how compound interest works and how investing for the long term is the more prudent way to develop wealth versus the jump in, jump out, jump in, jump out that a lot of people want to do by timing the market. It also incorporates things like having an estate plan, having a will, having adequate insurance to protect your assets. And for many of us who are self-employed, our biggest asset is ourselves, and making sure that things that would happen within the family dynamic would not change should something happen to us. I've had people tell me that, well, a will is not really part of a financial plan. They say, absolutely,
well, yes,
it is. Because it doesn't affect the value of your investments. It doesn't affect how you do asset allocation or what you're invested in. But in the event, what many people don't seem to realize, it's not a case of if you die. It's only a matter of when. Now, for myself, yeah, I'm counting another 35, 40 years, but there's no guarantee there. That, you know, in theory, it could be 3 weeks from now. And if something does happen,
it could be later today if you stepped off the curb.
It could actually be that. And now that you say that, I'm going to stay on the sidewalk and not step off the curb for the rest of the day. But at the end of it all, what I often tell people, and I use the line in the book, is that if you die without a will, you show complete and utter disregard for the people in your life that you say that you love. Because what happens then is it's an absolute mess to what happens to the people you left behind about decisions that have to be made, the division of assets, what happens to children, what happens if you're a business owner with a partner. And we could spend a whole show just talking about that concept. And so, again, it's those simple basic things that, if people understood them and applied those concepts over and over, they would probably be a little bit happier and a little bit less stress-induced about the future they're creating for themselves.
And that's so eloquently put about the importance of an estate plan and a will. You know, one of the things that really just terrorized me personally was when I was 18, my father asked me to be executor because he remarried, and I had a half-sister, and so he was concerned about who would raise her in the event that the two of them, like, were in a car accident or something, and my dad asked me if I would have custody of her and blah, 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 and so I said, okay. And there was this inference I took from that conversation that there was some sort of plan in place. And I am the oldest child, and when he died, and there was nothing, my brother and I were so confused, and the step monster went nuts. I mean, wouldn't even let me have a cigar box. And, I mean, I truly, from that side of the fence, can say that it's so selfish to at least not acknowledge, and it's not about the transfer of the assets. It wasn't about me getting anything. It was about me not being recognized by my father.
Right.
And that's what's so important about estate planning and the wills is, how do you want to be remembered? Because I was devastated by that, and that's what I think about.
Well, fortunately, I haven't had to go through that with my mom and dad yet. I know as an only child, at some point I will have to deal with that. And as you can imagine, I'm the executor of, their will and estate. Mm-hmm. But at this point in my life, I'm 49 years old, they will not share with me what dad gets from his company pension plan or the Canadian government's old age security plan, because as far as they're concerned, it's none of my business. So when we talk about the concept of money being emotional, for them, my mom and dad don't want me to understand the money that they've got for themselves. And as I often share with them, I don't really care about the money. I absolutely don't care about the money. Here's what I care about. At some point, I may have to make decisions on your behalf. And odds are, it's probable that I will have to make decisions on your behalf. And when that day comes, I do not want there to be any surprises. That's the thing I want to understand about you and mom. But that's a difficult conversation for parents to have with their kids and kids to have with their parents. But it's an incredibly important conversation, Heather.
And it's very simple. And we did a show on this with an estate planner. It's not about what happens when you die. It's what happens if you live and I have to take care of you and you cannot communicate to me what it is that you want, where you want it, how you want it.
Absolutely.
How can I possibly know that? I may be part Romanian, but I am not a mind reader.
No, none of us are. And the easier we make it for the people in our lives that we say we love, the better off we'll be. In the event that that day comes, that's why we buy insurance. We don't buy insurance because we think we're going to die. We buy insurance because we don't want there to be any issues when it happens.
Right. Well, it's just been such a great time with you on today's show, Robert. If folks are interested in getting your very funny, dysfunctional family look at financial planning, how can one go about getting your book?
Well, there are two ways they can do that. One, they can go to the website for the book, which is www.richisastateofmind.com. So it's the book title, all is one word, richisastateofmind.com. There are places and links to lots of online places they can order it. They can go to amazon.com and find the book there and order a copy if they're so inclined. At the book's website, there are sample chapters, there are book reviews, there are videos of me speaking at various industry events if they want to get some insight into what it is I do when I'm talking to financial advisors and clients. Or if they'd like to send me an email and have a question, I'd be happy to have a conversation with them.
Oh, well, that's so awesome. And thank you so much for spending time with us and having a conversation with us about finances. You have been listening to Robert Gignac on Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. Stay tuned. We have so much more in store coming up right after this.
Close more sales. Close more sales. Close more sales. Hi, this is Commander Marty Logan from the Top Gun Sales Academy. Are you the best salesperson you can be today? If not, allow us to help you to outpace your competition, your fellow peers, and recession-proof your business. Visit us at www.thetopgunseminars.com, 480-626-5883. Don't make excuses. Make it happen.
Are you a referral partner of the Unlock Your Wealth radio program? Would you like to promote your products and your services on our show? Learn about the benefits that our featured advertisers receive being part of an exclusive program where the listeners are seeking financial independence and are in need of your insurance, finance, real estate, and investment services. Call now at 1-866-966-9999. 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Reach the people who need your help the most with the Unlock Your Wealth radio show today.
Thank you.
that's fabulous that I just realized that I was muted this whole time. So I've been talking for the last 5 minutes without any airtime. So forgive me. Thank you so much for joining us. We are now into our Keys to Riches segment. And the Keys to Riches is a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money, but it also gives you specific techniques to create or fix your credit, reduce debt, save and invest, all while transforming your current financial habits into healthy money management skills. And we do that one key at a time, 1 week at a time. And this week's key is acceptance and affirmation. We're starting at the beginning of the season, at the beginning of the keys, and the beginning of the alphabet. Isn't that great? I love that. And so I've been asked before, why don't you have action as your first key? And I said, well, unless we address that we have something that we need to address, what are we going to do when we take action? Where are we going to go? Unless we identify that, A, we don't know anything about money and we need to know, B, what we thought about money wasn't exactly correct and we need to adopt a new way of thinking, or C, we've gone out and made some big mistakes and we don't know how to get out of them. So we can't take action until we accept we need to take some form of action. And denial is not just a place like a river in Egypt. It is a very comfortable place. It has big barca lounger sofas that we stretch out on and feel comfortable in. And so why would we ever leave denial? Because if we get out of denial and we accept where we are, well, crap, you know what that means? We got to do some work. And some of us are allergic to work. Some of us are afraid of the work. Some of us are in fear that no matter what we do, we're going to continue to make mistakes. But if we do the same thing over and over, expecting different results, we're going to continue to make mistakes. And so that's what paralyzes us, because we hope that the next time it'll be better. But we don't change how we do it. We don't go out and get more tools to fix what it is we're working on. We don't take the time to read directions in order to fix what it is that we're working on or to begin the project to begin with. We just kind of plod along. And staying in denial is very comfy and cozy because our inner curmudgeon says, don't get up. Stay on that sofa. Relax a little while longer. It's okay. Nothing's wrong. You're all right. And what we know about people is we are motivated by one of two things, pleasure or pain. But over 95% of us, big number, 95% of us will not change until the pain of change is less than the pain of staying the same. We do not get off that comfy sofa until it hurts to sit there. Until we get the bed sores from not moving, we won't get up. No matter how many carrots are dangled. I mean, think about it. We see images of luxury and wealth all the time on TV. We hear about it on the radio. We see it in the movies. It's glamorized by famous people. But how many of us get off our duff to go after it? 5%. I'll tell you how much, 5% of us are motivated toward pleasure. The rest of us, away from pain. So we got to make it so uncomfortable that we can't stand it the way it is. So that's why we have to take a serious look at our finances and our management of them specifically, because it's not about the dollar amount. I know some people that are uber fabulous at generating wealth. Making money is not the issue, because people say, well, if I just had more money, if I had this, if I did that. But it doesn't matter, because this particular person, whom I treasure dearly, spends more than he makes. And yes, it can happen at any income level. You don't have to be poor to spend more than you make.
But if you make money and you spend more than you make, you will be poor, no matter how rich you appear to be on the surface. You can lease a luxury lifestyle or you could live it for real, but that takes serious choices. And where do you choose to be? On the sofa, in denial? Or are you ready to get in the trenches and start learning about what it is that you need to do and taking action to make that happen? The first step you need to take is accept that what you're doing isn't working. The sooner you choose that, the sooner you free yourself. Most people enslave themselves to poverty just based on their choices. And their choices are based on childhood dramas that our parents put on us, but that's what shaped our belief system and our decision-making patterns. So, well, my parents did it that way. It must be right, right? My favorite quote that I always share with my husband is from Henry Ford, who says, "If you've always done it that way, it's probably wrong." And I love it. Because when something's not working and you continue to do it, it's like beating your head against the wall. So take that first step and accept that you need new information and perhaps a paradigm shift. Look at things from a different perspective. The next step is to create affirmations. This is a two-step process. You've got to accept where you are, but chances are you've been doing the same thing for so long, getting these crappy results, that you're scared, that you don't believe you have the capacity to change, that you're not worthy of it, whatever it might be. And affirmations, if structured properly, can carry you through where you need to be until you actually have the intestinal fortitude to see that through. I give you an example of that. You know, when people are kidnapped, especially women and females, they will fall in love with their captors. Even though they're committing this heinous thing, they'll fall in love with their captors because of the repeated exposure. They become inured to that person. Or think about spousal abuse, how long you tolerate it. Well, he didn't mean it or she didn't mean it or they were just lashing out and we make excuses for it because we become inured to that behavior. So if we can become inured to negative behavior, couldn't we also, through repeated exposure, become inured to positive behavior? And that answer is yes. Now we have an affirmation process called the 6 P's to affirmation success. And what we need to do is visit our website at unlockyourwealth.com because we are running out of time today, and I had to run the board myself, and so I didn't notice that my microphone wasn't back on, so we missed about 5 minutes worth of juicy broadcast. But if you sign up for that free membership today, you can visit our vault for the next 24 hours or an hour after our broadcast, after our two-hour show on Saturdays for 24 hours. This week's key strategy, which are the 6 P's to affirmation success, will be posted for your download. Premium members have 24/7 access to all the vault tools, plus webinars, plus chat rooms, plus all kinds of stuff. But if you visit our website, claim your free membership at www.unlockyourwealth.com, you can download today's 6 P's for affirmation success. And I am going to do something I've never done on the show here. Because we're getting cheated out of time here on the broadcast. I don't want to cheat you out of the value. So if you call me at 1-866-966-9420, 1-866-966-9420, and say, I want to sign up for the webinar, we will do a 6 P's for Affirmation Success webinar for free. All you have to do is sign up by giving me a call, because I don't have a web page to do that intake because I'm doing it off the cuff right now. So I want to thank you all for joining us on today's broadcast. Welcome to 2011. I'm so excited that you chose to bring in the new year with us. For more resources, visit www.unlockyourwealth.com. I'm Heather Wagenhall, your hostess with the Financial Mostest, saying thank you so much for joining us. And finally,
Financial independence can be yours at www.unlockyourwealth.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and you make it a millionaire year.